This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. And in case you're wondering, Kevin De Bruyne is still good at football. First appearance since August, and he strolls onto the pitch and plays two perfect passes. One into the net and one to Oscar Bob, who made it all look ridiculously easy in injury time. And perhaps this is, quote, where the title was won. Elsewhere, Spurs come back from behind twice to get a point at Old Trafford. A lot of the ball, but not quite enough end product. While United showed a bit of something at least and could have snatched it late on. Chelsea get their third win in a row. There's some VAR controversy for Vincent Kompany to stew over, while Villa can only draw Everton. There's some more FFP worries for Everton and Forest fan protests at Reading. Troy Deeney not exactly putting his arm around the shoulder. Match-specific NFTs and eating straight from the Salt Bay knife. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Mark says, good to see producer Joel giving the youngsters a fair run in the team. I mean, if this is the youngest squad we can put out, we're in real trouble, aren't we? Nader Manuaha, welcome.
Hello, sir.
Nuruddin Chowdhury, hello.
Hello.
And Paul McInnes, hi.
Hiya.
Owen says, can anyone think of a more, and that's what they've been missing, goal and assist than Kevin De Bruyne is on Saturday? Paul says, I was hoping Kevin De Bruyne's hair would be the opposite to Samson's, but unfortunately not. Every goal in this game was brilliant. On Match of the Day, I think it was Micah Richards, Glenn Murray and Gary Lineker all voted for Bernardo Silva's as the best. But Nadim, I think De Bruyne's is the best. Mm. And I will tell you why I think this, because I think almost no footballers would even consider doing what De Bruyne did and placing the ball where he placed it and just passing it in from there. Whereas I think a lot of players would have attempted the Bernardo. I think I've attempted a Bernardo Silva one. And like with a bit of luck, you can connect. But the Kevin De Bruyne one, I don't think if you're in that position, Nadim, that you would even think about.
No, if I was in that position, you see how the away fans are really high up, like at the highest possible point in Newcastle. I think I try and kick the ball up there to waste some time. You know, there's no way I'm doing that, what De Bruyne did. And I'm with you. I think the Bernardo Silva one is obviously a great finish. The other two, great and whatever. But even in an interview when De Bruyne's talking about the goal, he's talking about how he's reading the defender. The defender's trying to make himself big. And the reason he's trying to do that means I'm going to try and go through his legs. When I go through his legs, I'm not going to do it with like my laces. I'm going to use the side of my foot because it needs to be precision. These are a whole load of things I've never thought about before in the however many years I've kicked a ball towards a goal. So that's easily the best one for me. And the other ones are nice goals, but the De Bruyne one feels a lot more unique. So I'm with you, Mr. Hostman.
Thanks. Thanks very much. What a terrible superhero Mr. Hostman would be. Noz, and then the next question is, which pass is better? The pass from De Bruyne that he scores with, or the one to Oscar Bob, which feels... It feels like it's so inch perfect. Like we say inch perfect a lot, but if that's over hit, it goes out of play. If it's slightly less on it, then Trippier gets it.
Oh, completely. I think you're completely right. I think that Oscar Bob pass was amazing. It's a pass that is tried so often in football, and especially that time of the game where you kind of want to just get it over that last defender diagonally and. It needed to be perfect, and it was. And again, like the thing about De Bruyne is everything just looks dead effortless and aesthetically beautiful. So it's how casual it looks. I think that's, again, with his finish, it's always annoying when your team concedes a goal where it just rolls. It feels like a pass. And again, the pass for Oscar Bob, it's the time of the game and just the composure to do it then. It was annoyingly good.
And the other thing about De Bruyne and Paul is it is effortless, but also he doesn't really look like a footballer at the same time, if that makes sense.
Yeah, the haircut does contribute to that, doesn't it? I mean, it makes him look like...
Yeah.
And the way he dresses outside of playing, he looks like somebody who's working in the creative industries, perhaps designing a set backdrop for a new West End musical or something. But like, you know, I actually thought watching him play on Saturday, I thought he looked like, sorry to apply my amateur football experience to this, but he looked like somebody who'd been away from injury and was just coming back for a game. He would look desperate to play. And, you know, the way after the first goal as well, and he was kind of drumming everybody up. I think he's clearly missed that time. It's a long time to be out of the team, particularly, you know, when you went out of the Champions League final as well. I'm sure there's sort of a feeling that he's got unfinished business. So it was very good. But I just want to say, Oscar Bob's touch was just as good as that pass. I mean, if you're putting that on an inch, to take that and then to have the let's Nedim's running through the things that have to go through your head, to have the wherewithal to think, now I need to do something to beat the keeper, then to be able to pull that off with those tiny little touches and pass it in. A great goal, fantastic goal, the best one for me.
Yeah, and I suppose actually sort of within the, I know you have your City bias, Nedim, but within the sort of,
me?
It's not romantic, Man City winning everything, right? Like, they win everything, it's fine. But within that, the story of this guy, this 20-year-old scoring his first goal, and to be, yeah, and to be so good. Like, he takes three touches, which is so brilliant. Like, what a moment for him.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this was his seventh Premier League appearance as well. So he is basically brand new within this, even though he's played for Norway and stuff, and he scored for them, I think, in the last international break. This is one of City's academy players getting a chance to play in the first team, getting a chance to play at St. James's Park. I think he maybe played there in the League Cup, but to face it in the league for the first time, to face a Newcastle side who, for as much as they've had their ups and downs, they've been very good at St. James's Park, and you're coming on to try and make a difference and to score the winner, like in that place. I'm sure it's a goal, obviously, because it's his first to remember for a very, very long time. But what a goal as well, to be able to capitalise on the ball from De Bruyne, to make the run knowing the ball could arrive. And you're beating Kieran Trippier, who's been one of England's best right-backs over the last 10, 15 years, or however long it's been. So credit to him. Obviously, not everyone loves the story as such, but to see young people getting a chance in the Premier League and scoring goals like that, it does inspire that next lot. And I'm sure City's academy will be absolutely delighted with that.
Yeah, I just wanted to say something because I thought in a key passage of this game, City struggled. You know, when they went 2-1 down until De Bruyne came on, I think they looked a little bit lost. And I think the way that Newcastle kind of was shrinking the pitch was causing them problems. And I just think it's just interesting that when you've got Oscar Bob coming through at the very beginning of career, playing with no fear, executing perfectly, Kevin De Bruyne coming towards the end of his career, coming off the bench, making a difference, executing perfectly. Then in the middle of the game, you've got Foden and Alvarez, who are just coming in, you know, the younger years of their sort of prime years. And they were the guys who I kind of think the City were looking to decide that match for them, to make the difference. And they couldn't quite do it in that middle period of the game. And I thought that was something that was interesting about it. And I think it will be interesting to see now players are coming back from injury who gets in that first 11 now.
Eddie Howe's lost four in a row now. It did feel like the team were playing for him in this game. And we sort of speculated on how much pressure he's under or whether he's sort of getting, you know, he's sort of getting off scot-free at the moment. What do you think?
Well, it's an interesting one because you have these situations sometimes where the sort of critical mass of people who are sort of starting to question the manager or question his future come from outside the fan base. And you almost get a situation where non-Newcastle fans are perplexed and almost annoyed that Newcastle fans aren't turning on him. I think most Newcastle fans, or vast majority of Newcastle fans, realise the job he's done. And it's that thing of momentum or the order of your success. So if he'd had this season last season and last season this season, it would have showed progression.
Yeah.
But it's that thing of almost being too successful in last season. So if they'd missed out on Champions League football in a funny way, that would have made him more secure this season. But it's one of those performances, one of those games where that should give them confidence and it might help them kick on just because it felt like there was a bit of a change. And again, like, I know all teams have got loads of injuries at the moment, but Newcastle have got loads and they played really, really well. And there was like one or two players that you just think they're class. So, and Isak and Bruno, obviously being the two standouts. So, I mean, they could use it just to kick on now. Just going back to De Bruyne's here, because I think it's something that we shouldn't skirt over. I think that deserves a lot of credit as well, because how often as an adult do you make such a radical change to your hair? Like it doesn't happen often. It's a big thing to do.
Yeah.
Because you know you're gonna get ridicule. And also with the choices made, it's like a strange retro like Hugh Grant. So it's quite daring in a lot of ways, and And yeah, what I'd actually love is, do you know City have got this thing where they love to claim Manchester? And even with the kits, it's like every kit has got a sort of reference to Manchester. Oh, this is the Mosaic kit. This is like the Hacienda kit. I reckon there's potential here that what happens with De Bruyne's hair is he goes through the 90s of Manchester haircut. So at the moment, he's got like maybe a Russell Beardsmore early 90s. Maybe the next one is like Tim Burgess mop. And then it's like Liam Gallagher. You could bring it.
Mick Hucknall.
Mick Hucknall. It's the right. It's the right shade and everything. I just think there's opportunities there.
Clint Boone.
I don't know. Clint Boone. Excuse me.
In Spiral Carpets, mate. He had hair down to the hair down about there. Sort of like.
Oh, that's good.
Hey, Dougie style Bob.
I'll get yelled at for not knowing the name of the lead singer of In Spiral Carpets. Nadim, back to Newcastle. Do you have any strong thoughts on their plight?
Well, to be honest, I think a lot has been mentioned already about how like it's a lot of external people, probably myself included, sort of asking like, is everyone okay with this? But before that game against City, I think they had the third best home record, which makes you feel like, you know, it's going to be 50, 60,000 people every other week going to be feeling happy about their team as such. But if that starts to turn, and then that marries up with the fact they've got the second worst away record in the Premier League, only worse by Sheffield United on 2 points and Newcastle on 5, then all of a sudden you've got that sort of travelling fan base that's going everywhere and watching their team get nothing. And I understand the injury part of things, but again, everyone's got injuries. And maybe my disappointment with them has been at times a style of play as such, because I understand that they don't necessarily have the players that Howe wants to bring on off the bench. But at times I've seen them have 20, 30% possession, and that's for a team that's, you know, was playing Champions League at the start of the season. Doesn't feel quite right to me. But again, it'll be the fans that will speak up, because as we know in the North East, when they're not happy, they certainly make sure that they're heard.
To Old Trafford then, Man United 2, Spurs 2. Noz, was this a brilliant game or not? I thought it was sort of weirdly uninteresting and predictable in that the whole game was just Pedro Porro taking corners, as far as I could tell. And Spurs controlled it, but weren't incisive enough. And Man United showed a bit, but were still not. You didn't really know what they were trying to do.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of those games where if you're a Spurs fan, you're just thinking, like, get it to the line and like, get a corner, because you've got a really good chance of scoring. I mean, it's the same old problem with United at the moment, in that there's no style of play. It's that thing of... each game is just an objective in itself. Like, let's just get through this game. Let's just find a way to win this game or get a result. And there's no pattern, because I think often we think of, or football fans are portrayed as being spoiled and they only want success. I don't necessarily think that's true. I think what football fans feed off is some kind of hope and some kind of trajectory. So if they can see something developing, even if you lose a game, if they can see what's happening and they can see like a style of play that's being nurtured, then they'll forgive all sorts. They'll forgive bad results, and obviously Spurs fans are very forgiving of Postecoglou, because they can see what he's trying to do at United. The concerning thing over the weekend wasn't the result, because there's no shame in drawing with this Spurs side, and it was a good result in the circumstances, and United did show a bit of fight. The bigger concern is, what is this team? What is it trying to do? Why is it always reactive to the other team? Why has it not got the self-confidence to play? You've got this strange thing where near the beginning, when Ten Hag came in, and his Ajax team played this really attractive, structured style of play, possession-based, and he came in and said, United will not play that. And the reasoning was that they've not got the same kind of players and it's a different culture. So then the immediate question becomes, why don't you create that structure? Why don't you, every single time you've got a transfer window, buy players that will be able to play in that way? And instead, what he's done is it's all patch-up work, and the team looks like a patched-up team. There's never any pattern. There's never any signs of hope. It's just get through the game, and I think that is the biggest concern. It's a team of footballers that are clearly good footballers, because they do it at international level. They've done it at previous teams, and now are doing it a little bit for teams on loan. But as a team, as they are currently at United, they look like bad footballers. They look like they've got bad technique, which is concerning. I mean, I'd be interested what you think, Nedim, as an ex-footballer. Like, can you see what United are trying to do and what the players have been told to do?
So I was speaking with Mark Ogden about this yesterday, and he made a good point that United basically are a team that just split into thirds. Like, there's the defensive side of things. You've got the midfield who sort of work at times just independently of the other segments. So then you've got the forward line. You don't
like
see
a table
thing.
Football team. They're a football team, yeah, aren't they? They're just attached in that bit, but there's no link.
That's the line, yeah. That's the name of the pod. Yeah, we figured it out. But I think whereas you look at a team like Spurs at this moment in time, and you think of all the injuries they've had, people are away, international duty, and so on. But you kind of see, like, the play goes here, then it goes there, then it goes there, then it goes there. And even though it might fall that final hurdle, they've got a three-layered process to get the ball there. Whereas if United, like, Onana has the ball at the back, the centre-backs might split, but then there's not a really obvious split that then happens in midfield, which then leads to attack. So they don't really have long periods of, like, good possession against good sides because there's no real structure behind it, in my mind. But they must be working on it. And I think at times, you know, for the Spurs line, for the Villa line, they do try and test it, and their forward line will sort of define them as such. But yeah, you can see that, I think, to put it into perspective, if the Spurs team that went out to play against United yesterday was their last season with their previous manager, we'd look at it and say, wow, that team is so, so bad. They're probably going to really struggle. But instead, they went to Old Trafford and they controlled large parts of the game themselves and will feel disappointed that they didn't get anything from it with the amount of players that they've got missing.
It's interesting the way you describe the game, Max, because I can see it when you describe it like that. But I was really enjoying watching it. And I haven't seen so much of Spurs, but I was loving the way they were building those triangles, loving the way that people were kind of thinking, well, how's the way I'm going to bend the ball around the man who's close to me so I can complete that triangle? And everybody on the team was willing to do that. And then the ingenuity they had sometimes to find the space to just punch through that midfield with one pass, the number of times that they opened up into that final third. It was just like, yeah, there's some great technical ability here. You're thinking watching that game, and you remember that these are second, third string players who never really kind of would have seen the pitch under Conte. So it's like, it's I think he can get, you know, he's obviously good at kind of getting stuff out of these players, and they want to play for him right now. But I think he's just sold them a message that they can believe in, and I'm not sure what that message is that Ten Hag's given to his squad.
Do you think it's harder, Nedim, to be brave in a Manchester United shirt because losing is a bigger deal as a Man United player than it is a Spurs player, but because of that, you lose more?
that's a very good question you've asked me there. And to be honest, like, I understand the idea of, oh, this is Man United and so on and so forth, but then you'd like to think that they wouldn't necessarily be recruiting people who'd be scared of playing at Old Trafford. You know, you've got some players in the team who've been there for a while, players who are international players who've played at European Championships, World Championships, whichever confederation they're in. And, you know, like, even the likes of, like, Casemiro, he's got more Champions League titles than, say, most teams have got league titles. But I don't know. I don't really buy into that. Obviously, when you do go there, there's probably more scrutiny from a negative perspective at Man United than any other club in the world, as I see it. Because you look at Real's, Barca, and so on. They've had more success recently. So it's not all doom and gloom. But yeah, it seems like some people, they really do struggle. They struggle at times with confidence. But this kind of goes to the question I was asking before. If you had a manager who gave you a style of play which you believed in, all of a sudden you can do something on the field in unison and look a lot better. Because I see United every week and I see the starting 11 and I think that they can do better than they end up doing. And at times you see flashes, but then you don't see it over a long period of time. But maybe, as Ten Hag's been trying to say, when people come back in, maybe they'll be great. Maybe. Who knows? But that top four being 8 points behind it right now, I don't personally see it. But yeah, I don't think obviously, I can't. This seems so stupid, me saying this from a City perspective. But yes, there is scrutiny for players who play for United, but the players are there for a reason and they should be able to do better. And if they're not doing better, the question is why? Is it down to them? Or is it down to the environment that they're in? And ultimately, you'll never know because no one will say.
It's an interesting point that Ten Hag made, you know, when we get all our players back. Because if you think about the players that Tottenham are missing, you think, well, actually, you know, Son is at the Asia Cup, Madison. I mean, we had a question from Simon going, I think if Spurs had a fully fit team, there'd be a good few points clear at the top. Am I a delusional dreamer? And you do wonder, and yeah, you're probably right, but if Madison had been fit this whole time, Noz, I just think it would have been it could be so different. He was playing so brilliantly.
That's exactly it. I mean, it's difficult because sometimes it's marginal gains with players coming back, but the players that they've got missing and how important they were. They'd absolutely be better off up the league, and considering it's so early in Postecoglou's tenor, that's amazing. And the fact he's playing this daring football, and it's interesting that, like, the point that Paul made about sort of the way that they probe and even, like, have the bravery on the ball. And that thing about taking risks. The thing is, the United team take risks as well, but it's blind risks. The amount of blind balls that this United team sort of play, and it's around the corner, and it's into space, and it's just assuming or hoping that somebody will be there. It's not controlled, and there's no order, whereas Spurs do show order. And this whole thing about Ten Hag talking about the injuries, it's funny how the... I mean, it's true, but it's funny how the tune changes. When things are going well, managers in general are quite bullish and sort of say, I'm not going to use injuries as an excuse. But then as soon as they're going badly, they do. But I think Spurs are kind of the flip side of United at the moment, where you look at Spurs and you kind of think, because they're managed so well, because they know exactly what they're doing, players can be out injured or suspended or whatever, and the players that come in still perform well like they did on the weekend, because they know exactly what they're doing, and that absence of players does not make the difference it should. But at United, there's all this talk about Casemiro's coming back, and you don't feel as if that's going to improve things, because United were poor when those players were in the team before they were out. So yeah. so it's kind of, there's not even an optimism there, because you kind of think, well, they kind of play the same kind of clunky, disorganised, dislocated way when those players were in the team. So I think it's hard to move away from the thought. And again, like it's not as if I'm saying United should get rid of Ten Hag at this stage, but it's that thing of it comes down to the manager, it comes down to the players knowing what they should be doing, and it's not a case of Spurs have just got these really receptive, intelligent players, and United haven't. It's about how they're organised.
I think Nuz is right as well, because he mentions those players for United who had to come back in, and on paper, those are like big names as such. Talking about Casemiro's, you know, you're looking at, say, Short, left back, who I'm sure, for as much as people don't like Short, they'd likely prefer him to Wan-Bissaka at left back. But from the Spurs side of things, the players who are missing for them are ones who we've seen have really good seasons to this point. When you're looking at Saar, looking at Bissouma, looking at Maddison, looking at Son, so you can see that their ceiling will be up. But to go back to the original question, Spurs being clear at the top if you had the older players, well, surely every team up near the top could say exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But yeah you know, this is, I guess this is how it goes.
Do you know what? I'm so guilty. You know, we always say fans' expectations change so quickly. And Paul, you're absolutely right to watch that Spurs game like that, because I've watched a lot of Spurs. I'm now used to this is how Spurs play. Whereas if a year ago I'd watch Spurs, you'd tell me in a year, Spurs will be dominating the ball, playing little triangles, I'd have basically fainted, especially with, you know, the manager that we had. So I am as guilty as all other football fans. Quickly on Timo Werner, Rob says, was that shot by Timo Werner in the 21st minute? Just him exorcising the banter out of himself for the rest of the season. I'm convinced he's going to score buckets, as I was at Chelsea, Paul. What did you make of this performance?
Assist on debut, right? That's his. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good start. Especially in a game like that. I think you talk about, there's so much stuff we don't know about all of football, and I think pressure and expectations is a big part of that. And him coming in here, the expectations are going to be different from the time he played at Chelsea. You know, he was supposed to be the man who led the line. Now he's emergency cover. He's not even going to be playing centrally, you know, provided Richarlison stays fit. So I think the upside's quite big on this deal, and I thought he played well because I thought he looked intelligent, mobile, and knitted in with the rest of the team. Yeah, I mean, that finish wasn't great. I think he had another effort as well that wasn't superlative. But, you know, if you're not buying him for that or getting him into the team for that, which I'd imagine they're not, then, yeah, I think he looks like he could slot right in and do a job.
Finally, for part one, Barca Jim saying, can Noz really call himself a true United fan? As I know for a fact, he doesn't possess any game-specific NFTs. This is in relation, Noz, to Manchester United tweeting, Old Trafford, we're back. Make sure you're prepared for our first home game of 2024. The ultimate match day checklist, match day programme, game-specific NFTs, buy match day shirt, make United predictions. It is the match day essentials, isn't it, Noz? I won't leave home without my Cambridge United-specific NFTs. I believe the tweet was deleted. Not the most embarrassing thing. We'll get onto Chelsea's publicity stunt in a bit. But still, you just, I mean, what do you do?
Jim's right. The most embarrassing thing is where you go to a game and you've got you sort of pack your NFT, but it's not the game specific one. it's the last game's NFT that you've got, and then you've got this embarrassing thing where you've got like people like you've got people selling half and half NFTs outside the map. Like I just think it's a mess of my feel, but yeah, I never leave home without mine.
All right, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll begin at Stamford Bridge. Hi, Pod fans. Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May the 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. So three wins on the spin for Chelsea. They beat Fulham 1-0. I mean, the staggering thing for me, Nadim, about this game was that Fulham didn't equalise. I was just sitting there waiting for them to score. And actually, as the game went on, the later it got, I wasn't like, well, even when there was like there's a minute more of injury time had been played, I was like, this is when they're going to score. It wasn't like at any time I thought Chelsea would win until probably about 5 minutes after full time.
So is this where we give like Chelsea a bit of credit for finding a way? Is this a spin? Can we do positive spins?
You can do whatever you like. You could do whatever you like.
Could we spin it and say Fulham, like, they're good, but to a point? Like, which narrative should we roll with, do you reckon? Which one's more progressive? Do you get more Chelsea fans or Fulham fans in here? Let me make a decision now.
You can speak. You have to speak your truth, Nadim.
Well,
this
to be
your,
fair.
This is your life and your journey.
As a former QPR player, it should have been a draw. But anyway, it's a shame for Fulham because I saw them in midweek as well against Liverpool, and there were parts where they looked really good, but they came away with nothing because they got worse as the game progressed, and obviously Liverpool got better. And then in this game here, I fancied them to get something as well, but we're in a position where Chelsea, you know, sometimes they go through good spells, they're playing well, but then they'll always offer opportunities to the opposition. And it seems like for now, they're kind of getting away with it in the league. I think that's three wins in a row, and that's them climbing the table. That's them, what is it? 3 points behind sixth, the thing that you never thought we'd see when we're talking about Chelsea in 2023-24. They're doing it somehow. And, you know, that will be an important win for them.
Yeah, but they're getting away with it in ninth. I mean, that isn't where Chelsea should be getting away
Well, it's in ninth for now. That's the point, Max. It's ninth for now. No, you know, they are climbing the table. And whether it's through gorgeous football or whether it's people criticising them for not having a style of play, wasting money, people being injured all the time, blah, blah, blah. Like, the winning sort of like feeling does exist. And I think even if you walk off a field and feel like you've gotten away with it, you still have a nicer training week. And in fairness, they've got the break now as well, haven't they? They're going somewhere warm with another 3 points in their back pocket, and they're looking up the table thinking, I wonder if we can catch them. So it's not a perfect game, not a perfect performance, but it's a win nonetheless. And given the fact that, say, for the last 18 months, basically, we've seen them at times play well and lose, I think Pochettino will just take it, especially as a reaction to, you know, going up to the northeast to play Middlesbrough, just to let Middlesbrough take a 1-0 lead. So, yeah, I'm not going to be too down on Chelsea as such, but they obviously still have some more work to do.
I think you're right. Cole Palmer is the sort of story for Chelsea at the moment, Paul. It's probably too far to suggest he's carrying them, but he's such a lovely footballer, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he's beautiful to watch just because he does the unexpected, you know? He's brave, he's technically gifted, and he's willing to do things on a pitch that excite the crowd, I think primarily, but also at this moment in time are creating big chances, or at least opening up the pitch to give the opportunity to create chances. I think if you read too much social media, you can definitely get a counter narrative on Palmer, which is that off the ball, there's not so much of a contribution at this point in time. And that you know, they gave up, what was it, 14 shots against Fulham. That is obviously an issue for a broad issue for the team, that they give up too many attacking opportunities to their opponents. And I thought what was quite interesting in terms of, if we talk about narratives, is that actually Conor Gallagher is a very technically gifted footballer. who can do a lot of things on the ball that other people can't. But because he is somebody who's determined to make it at Chelsea and has sort of had to reinvent himself as a shuttler, as somebody who gets in there and just disrupts and does all the hard yards in order just to justify placing the team, which to my mind, he could have on his own technical abilities anyway. I thought it was his performance against Fulham was perhaps the key one for me, because he was the one who was actually doing the stuff off the ball. He was involved in the better passing movements. He also had that incredible outside of the foot. Is that a Trivella? That strike when you hit it like that and it came off the post?
I think that's a Trivella. Not necessarily on this podcast, but I think the young people call it Trivella, yeah.
Sort of a charisma effort, yeah. It was really nice. Do you think he's running around more than Caicedo and Enzo and looking behind him going, you cost, what, 200 million quid or 180 million quid? What are you doing?
Yeah, it is mad. But I mean, madder than that is the fact that there's been talk about him perhaps leaving and maybe going to Spurs. And you kind of think, like, who in their right mind would think that that's a good idea? Just because, like, he's so integral to this team. And he's the kind of player who sets an example for those bigger stars. But yeah, I think he did really well. And I think, again, along with, I hate to be another plaudit for Palmer, but... he just looks class. He looks absolute class, and those two together are a big reason why Chelsea look like they are at least playing slightly better than they were. I think the worst thing for me about Palmer is along with Foden, it just shows how good the players coming through City are in terms of that almost what used to be thought of as like the technique that continental players had. So like both of them in different ways feel very, very continental, and like Cole Palmer almost feels like Kaká in the way he moves and plays, and the fact that he's from, I think, Withenshaw and Foden's from Stockport, it's kind of, there's almost like a begrudging admiration that these local lads are being coached to play in a way that we used to rave about foreign players like in the 90s.
So actually, that Kaká comparison is really interesting. He does move a bit like that, doesn't he? A good touch for a big man. I mean, but that should be reserved for target men and not for Kaká, really, shouldn't it? But anyway, Christopher Nkunku wasn't on the pitch. Poch says, we're disappointed and a little bit worried because we want him involved again as soon as possible. It's complicated with Christopher. It's now between 8 and 10 days since he could train. I mean, it sort of feels like he's saying he thinks he should be training. I mean, maybe lost in translation. I'm not sure. There were 7 people dressed as spies in the press box, I think, or sort of certainly near the dugouts, who stood up during the first half to read a book. Later on, were brushing their teeth. Pochettino says they were promoting the upcoming film Argyle, made by Matthew Vaughan, who is a Chelsea fan. Pochettino said, for the fans, I think it's nice to see the promotion of the film. And I think it looks very, very good. They've invited me for the premiere. Lots of outlets claim that Todd Bowley was somehow involved in a production company associated with the film, but apparently that is not true. But still, Paul, if you're a Chelsea fan, you just don't want this sort of nonsense. I mean, obviously it doesn't matter, but like, maybe if you're doing really well, but even then, I don't know. Or should I just be like, look, it's all entertainment. Some people like film, some people like football, some people like both. Most people like both, I imagine.
I wonder whether there's a little twist on it that makes it even worse. So it's not just the kind of 360-degree surround entertainment experience, but it's also referencing that fan who brushed his teeth in 2009. Yeah. Is that? So it's like, hey, guys, we're diving into Chelsea legend here for you guys. We know you're going to love it. And get your specific NFT after the match.
Burnley 1, Luton 1. A total heartbreak for your good friend, your best friend, Vincent Kompany. Big story is the end of the game where... it was Adebayo, wasn't it, who thrust his backside towards James Trafford. And Kompany said, first, I expect the referee to see it. It was that obvious. None of the Luton players have celebrated. Nobody. The first look from the striker, which is normal, nothing against him. He's doing his job. But the first look of the striker is towards Trafford. After this, it's towards the referee to see if he got away with it. Luckily, we've got VAR. We think, okay, that's going to sort it. Then it rolls. Lack of decision, and that's it. Burnley are 1-1. It's a foul, isn't it, Nadim? I mean, I was certain it was and expecting a full Howard Webb, giant apology letter until some people started saying it isn't a foul. And now I'm lacking the conviction to be certain it's a foul.
So have you guys ever had David James on here?
We have not.
David James would be perfect for this. Okay. Like he suits this to the ground. And I speak to David quite a lot through one of the groups that I'm in, and he's a big like laws of the game, rules freak type person. Right. Always wants to explain everything, throw loads of stats at it. And he, the former goalkeeper, England goalkeeper, we should add, said it was not a foul.
Right.
And he said the reason it's not a foul is because the foul comes when a goalkeeper is attempting to catch the ball and then they are fouled.
Right.
Whereas he said with the Trafford incident, he's blocked and then he throws his arms in the air to attempt to catch it. So as a consequence, he said that isn't a foul. And in the group that we're in, basically everyone was like biting his head off. But I thought, well, if a member of the goalkeepers union, although, you know, his membership card is a bit dusty now because he's so old, is saying that, then that was felt like a learning point for me. So yeah, from what I'm hearing, that isn't a foul. But then we then ask the question, well, why have so many decisions been given in the past? And I think it's that nuance that David was trying to say, whereby if a goalkeeper's coming to claim it and their arms are in the air, for example, and then they get nudged, then I think that gets given as a free kick. But if not, then I guess it's just a case of the goalkeeper being an open play. But I think as Vincent Kompany said, it was a bit awkward when everyone's looking at the ref like, okay, he's gonna disallow this. Then you go to video, okay, they're going to disallow it. But then I suppose if this is it now, maybe this is the precedent for us to either understand or for them to sort of make these sort of decisions more often going forward.
I can't speak for the listeners, but all I want to know is who else is in this group, Nadim. That's the only...
It's a wild group in there. It's a wild group there. Talk about XG and all sorts in the middle of the night.
Is it all ex-footballers?
Mostly ex-footballers, yes. Right, mostly, okay. If an older generation, yes. Mostly.
Older generation. Can we all have a get? Jay Bothroyd.
No, really not Jay Bothroyd. No, not Jay Bothroyd.
Michael Ricketts. It's Michael Ricketts.
No. This, to be fair, this one is more specific to people who've played for Man City. That's what I'd say.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, there are a few. That's good.
Terry Phelan.
Terry Phelan's not made this one, no. Not made this group.
Stephen Ireland.
Stephen Ireland's not in this one, no. He does not like
Uwe
group chat.
Rosler. Is Uwe Rosler in this?
No, but a couple of his teammates are in this group chat, yes.
Okay. Wow. Okay. Alan Kernahan.
No, surprisingly, Kerner hasn't made this group. No, he has not. He has not.
Should we just spend the rest of the podcast just shouting out City players? Gary Flitcroft.
Who's the biggest? Who's the biggest gun in this one? Edin Dzeko.
The biggest. Edin's still kind of playing, so he couldn't possibly spend time chatting to us. No, okay, not this one. Fine. Listen, I'll give you the info all in due time. Next time I'm on, I'll tell you all about it.
Okay. Well, surely every time you're on, we'll have one guest until we get one player who's in it. Noz, you had your hand raised before I started playing a ridiculous guessing game.
Yeah, I mean, I'd just say about David James, like, you're right, like, obviously it's good to get a perspective from a goalkeeper, but, like, we've got to remember that he did get murked by Rio Ferdinand, so that you've got to question his judgment. And also, I wonder whether we should have, like, in the rules of the game, whether we should have a whole set of rules about arse use. Like, is he in full control of his arse? Is that a dangerous arse? Is that a reckless arse? I mean,
it's the least reckless part of the body, you'd suggest, wouldn't it? It's the sort of softest.
Well, I beg to differ.
I mean, it depends on what circumstances, of course, but in a footballing context, I think of all the parts of the body that you could hit somebody with, I mean, this is a dangerous path to go down, but I think it would cause the least...
No. Like I said, have you seen John McGinn play? Like, people actually say that's his big... I was going to say his biggest asset, but that's too obvious now, isn't it? But yeah, sorry, Max, please take over.
No, it's okay. I was playing five-a-side in Sydney with Craig Foster, who was a former Socceroo, and he's very good mates with a guy called Adam Goods. He's like the most famous AFL player of all time. He's also a very good footballer. And he would thrust his posterior towards you, and it was like, well, there's no way I can get anywhere near this bottom. He had obviously most players with a large backside also have, you know, thighs to match, don't they? So all of that means, yeah, you're absolutely right. So let's go to Goodison. Everton 0, Villa 0. What did you make of this one, Paul?
Well, I think it's a good result for Everton, really. if you look at the perspective from the beginning of the season, because they defended very well. They looked like they got that most challenging aspect of the team. You know, after having three defeats on the bounce, there were questions again about where Everton were, and I think that sort of reset that. And you know, Villa are third in the league. That's no bad point for Everton. I think for Villa, yeah, and probably should have won as well. I think that Donovan Calvert-Lewin chance was pretty golden. For Villa, you know, their away form continues to be the poor relation of the home form, and that's why I think that, you know, they're not in the title race, and the top four battle will be a long one. I, you know, no argument. That doesn't change the fact that Emery's doing amazing things and that the team's moved on. And, you know, but I think that showed a little bit of the limitations of where Villa are right now.
Brian says, can we have a moment to acknowledge Seamus Coleman, please? Everton's record appearance holder, consistently one of the best right backs in the Premier League in his prime. All round good lad. His experience on and off the pitch remains vital to Everton. Presumably not in a WhatsApp group with Seamus Naylor, but I don't know. But that notwithstanding, especially for what he cost, what an amazing career he has had.
Yeah, so was it £60,000 transfer fee? That's can't even pay for a player per week for that these days. But it's a great signing for them. I remember when he first arrived, and it's this guy's come over from Ireland, and said, "Oh, will he be good? Will he be bad?" And then very quickly, you know, he was like a key part of who Everton were. And even though we see Everton these days like being lower down, we all remember them being really good as well. And he was a big part of that. And for him to take that record, like to be at a club for 15 years, that's amazing. You know, most people, if you get five, like that's an incredible stretch. But for him to be there that long, for him to be the number one, for him to go past, you know, a club legend like Tim Howard, who I think was on 3-5-4. And best of all, he's not done yet. And even though we don't see the absolute best of him, it's still good to see him healthy, fit, being out there and representing his team, because he does signify who Everton are as a football club. Because whenever I think about them anyway, I think of him and others playing within that side. It's a huge credit. 355 Premier League games so far for them, for somebody, as I say, who costs next to nothing. Amazing achievement. It was a pleasure playing against him, although he tended to beat me, especially at Goodison. It was a pleasure, and it's good to see old people out there still making an impact.
For those of you who liked football before 1992, he is 15th on the list of all-time appearances, if I've added it up properly. Neville Southall, way out, big Neff, greatest goalkeeper of all time. 751 appearances. Brian Labone, 534. And Dave Watson, 528. David Ornstein reporting in The Athletic last night, saying Everton and Nottingham Forest are expecting to be referred to an independent commission over breaches of the Premier League's profitability and sustainability regulations. Clubs will learn on Monday, i.e. today, whether they've fallen foul of the league's financial rules under new guidelines introduced to ensure any basic breaches are dealt with in time for punishments to be levied in the same season as a charge is brought. Under the guidelines, both clubs are now at risk of a fine or a points deduction, with formal notification of any charges set to come on Monday. Both clubs have prepared mitigation and are expected to robustly argue their case. We will talk about that in more detail. I'm sure a lot of people listening will say Manchester City have a lot of charges that may not be resolved this season. Noz, your hand is raised.
Yeah, I just wanted to quickly go back to the game before we move on. One of the things, I mean, first of all, I just love the game because it was so spicy. Like for a game that I just thought there's no obvious rivalry between Villa and Everton, there was loads of little arguments and fights going on in the game, which was great to see. But also, I was fascinated by that offside situation where it looked as if Villa had decided to use Danjuma as some sort of some sort of meat puppet that they were just going to stick on the floor, so that means that they're onside. And I just wondered whether is that an innovation in shithousery, or does that go on? Has that happened before, where somebody's been sort of manipulated physically to make your team onside?
Wasn't Salah pushed offside recently? Was it against Burnley or something? Like he was sort of, because he was in the keeper's eye line, but he'd been shoved. And so when you're still offside, but like you've been fouled, it's a very good question. It doesn't seem to arise that much, but I do like the idea of defenders just picking up their nearest attacker and hurling them into an offside position, but it not being a free. Or, I mean, I guess what you could do is you could use your backside, because we've established that is not necessarily a foul. So
if that was John McGinn, it's definitely onside, by the way. Like Dan Juma would just be pressed against the post.
Anyway, that'll do for part two. Before we end it, we just wanted to send our best wishes to the friends and family of Ian Purslow, the 71-year-old lifelong Bolton Wanderers fan who died watching their home game with Cheltenham. The game was abandoned after he was taken ill. The club said Ian, who lives in Oldham, was at the game supporting the Whites with his son Stuart. The club chaplain remained with family members late in the day. The club will continue to offer the family all the support they can, as well as looking to offer support to anyone else impacted by this distressing incident. The thoughts of everyone connected to Bolton Wanderers are with Ian's family and loved one at this incredibly sad time. Ian will be remembered at Wanderers FA Cup third round replay at home to Luton Town on Tuesday night. We'll be back in a second. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Reading's game with Port Vale was abandoned after a number of Reading fans peacefully protested on the pitch against the current ownership. We'll cover the story in detail. We're speaking to someone from the fan-led group Sell Before We Die, DAI, with reference to the owner, Dai Young. We've had lots of questions about it. I just wanted to read this email from Tom, which is quite long but worth reading, and we'll get to it in more detail on Thursday. He says, "Hi, I'm a long-time listener, massive fan of the pod. I just want to make a plea about covering the plight of Reading FC, which this week has accelerated like never before. I first started going when I was 6 years old. I'm now 30. I've watched the club through its glory years, two promotions to the Premier League, three FA Cup quarterfinals, even a semi-final just 8 years ago, where we were just a goalkeeping error away from a first major final in our 125-year history. To many fans listening to the pod, the idea that these modest achievements would qualify as glory years may seem incomprehensible, but for a club of Reading size, those years still mean everything to the fan base. Now to see all those years of growth count for nothing with the rapid asset stripping of the club, including the best youth players and senior players, and even our youth academy, I believe the only Cat 1 academy below the Championship, and a source of pride for fans, being systematically destroyed by an absent owner is gut-wrenching. For fans of clubs like Reading, of which Max is one in Cambridge, all we want from football is to celebrate 3 points on the weekend more often than not and socialise with family and friends. If I lose this football club, I lose quality time with my dad, I lose friends, and I lose the quiet games I sometimes spend alone when all I want to do is take a break from my busy working life, hop on the train to Reading from London and forget about everything for 90 minutes. Our owner, if you can call him that, Dai Young, and his number two, Dai Pang, are callously ripping out the heart of this team, despite being wealthier than you can ever imagine. I'm writing this on the way to Port Vale at home, where there could be huge fan action. Our story needs highlighting now more than ever by fantastic outlets such as yourselves. I love football and the Premier League too, but mainstream football all pales into comparison to Reading FC and other clubs like us at this point in time. If not the worst part of this ideal is a loss in interest in the wider football game. It feels like Dai Young isn't just taking this club away from me and my fellow fans, but the entire sport too, for which I will never forgive. As I said, I'd be appreciative if you read this out. The words aren't just relative to me nor Reading fans, but football fans everywhere. It's high time action was taken in the wider game to address football's wider ownership problems. Thanks so much for reading. And that's from Tom. Dai Young Pang, the club CEO, said very tough decisions, unfortunately, have had to be made. Pang told fans Dai Young is actively working to secure the sale of the club. Fans refused to leave. They went on the pitch in the 16th minute. Reading's manager, Ruben Sellers, hung around for a long time. Port Vale fans were very understanding as well. As I said, we'll talk about it on Thursday. Jim says, one for Nadim. If you were playing for Forest Green, how would you react to Troy Deeney's post-match comments at the weekend, assuming you're not a fan of that kind of chat? Have you played with any players who would respond positively to it? He said there are, quote, too many babies from top to bottom. First half was boring. I'd rather watch frigging Antiques Roadshow than that. No offence to anyone who likes Antiques Roadshow. Not sure anyone has put the word frigging before Antiques Roadshow before. But anyway, that kind of sort of throwing under the bus chat, Nadim, your thoughts?
It's very much being placed under the bus going forward and backwards, then forwards again. Troy is and has been very outspoken, hasn't he? So it's interesting that now he's having to manage a group of people. And if he believes that this is the best way to get the best out of them, then good luck. But I would say personally, being run over several times by the bus, being driven by the manager, isn't something that I would enjoy that much. And for Forest Green and other teams down there, it's not as if they can have total player turnover as well, is it? So But maybe this is all part of his master plan to get Forest Green up to the Premier League, win the Premier League, and then win the Champions League in the next 10 years. Who knows?
Yeah, yeah. But if a manager throws a player under the bus in public, what's the dressing room reaction to? I can't see how a dressing room would react well to that. But yeah, but you know, managers like Jose and Conte have had success.
Yeah, but not necessarily like this. I mean, in terms of like an attack, because like Troy's relatively new there anyway, isn't he? And
yeah,
we'll see what Troy thinks, if he'll say stuff like this again going forward. Because one thing that he's probably seen himself firsthand is that if the manager loses the players, the manager will likely lose their job. So now he's in a position where, as manager, are the players still on side with everything that you're saying? And he's saying a lot, and it's very entertaining. But I think functionally, from a work standpoint, I wouldn't believe that's going to be helping him anytime soon get some results.
Yeah, some really weird appointments since Rob Edwards, who was clearly brilliant at Forest Green. You know, Duncan Ferguson was a strange appointment. Troy Deeney, you know, good to get opportunities, but still, you know, a lack of experience seems to be showing. Luke says, how much would the panelists have to be paid to be fed meat by Salt Bay? Ash says, is it possible to still give everything for a manager once you've seen them be fed like Arteta has this week? Jonathan, would Big Ange be seen dead at Salt Bay's restaurant? Noz, I don't know if you've seen the video of Arteta being fed by Salt Bay and then sort of rubbed slightly on the shoulder.
It made me sick. There's something visceral about a man feeding someone like they're a baby bird. It's just. Do you know that thing that footballers like often say is that I'd rather a player go in two-footed rather than spit at me or something. Like, I would rather Salt Bay punch me in the face than feed me in that weirdly erotic way. It's unnecessary. It's bringing the game into disrepute. And I reckon questions need to be asked about Arteta, to be honest, because I just think his position is untenable now.
Yeah, I mean, I people would accuse me of being biased, but it feels, Paul, worse than an FFP breach to me.
No way, man. You've got to think about the community and the role that football plays in the game at large. Oh, hang on a minute. He did get fed by Salt Bay. I don't get what the attraction is. He looks like a Johnny Depp impersonator. That kind of like meat based, I mean, oh, I just feel like, oh, it's like a Roman orgy or something. And I don't know why any kind of like somebody's clearly doing calorie denying on a daily basis would want to go there in the first place. I don't know. But yeah, it's not for me. Thank you very much.
I mean, in many ways, I guess Salt Bay is sort of like Robin Hood. At least he must have been at the start, Nadim. Like he was stealing from the rich. He's not necessarily giving it to the poor, I guess. I agree. I just can't understand. Like credit to him for managing to turn to become presumably incredibly wealthy by doing something as Paul says, it is like a Roman orgy. Yeah, it's so grotesque.
Yeah, it's somewhat of a phenomenon. I was just watching the video then, and it is hilarious, to be honest. But like Salt Bay and lots of other places, like it's the place to be seen. And then the bill comes and everyone realizes it's overpriced. But until you do it for the first time, you don't really know. But when you're sitting down in the chair and then you see the prices, it's like, well, we can't really get up and deal with this now. And Arteta, like that video is hilarious. Like when the little kid comes over, unless it's Arteta's kid, putting the salt on the steak.
I think it might be. It might be. I don't know. But like,
listen, some things are better done. If you're going to do it without a camera being there, because then at least you can pretend it never happened. But like, it's out there. Yeah. And when, like, to just picture it, the next time Arsenal lose, should Arsenal lose again this season, who's going to be the manager just like sticking a steak in his mouth or something? You know, this is it. He set himself up. It's nightmare fuel. But I hope he enjoyed his steak. I'm sure it was expensive. And I hope he enjoyed his break.
I mean, the thing is, nothing can taste that good. Nothing. You would not go through any sort of culinary sort of like magic of that bite for someone to sort of do that. In fact, I think we've stumbled upon, like, we're talking about Troy Deeney. Maybe the punishment for his comments is for Salt Bay to do it, but it's got to, because it's Forest Green, it's got to be a sliver of like
tofu,
vegan, like corn dipped into his mouth. And I would pay good money to see Troy Deeney and how he'd react to any of that nonsense.
It's basically with this Arteta thing, if it was good, I'm sure Arsenal fans would be sharing it. But the fact that everyone else is sharing it suggests it's probably like a bit of an embarrassment for your whole camp. But, you know, this is where we're at.
Honestly, like, And a steak is, like, you can get a decent fillet steak for, what, a tenner? £7? Cook it at home. You know, like no. I don't know how dramatically you pour the salt on it. It's just a steak.
Yeah, but have you ever been fed steak on a saber by Salt Bay in Dubai?
No.
If the answer is no, you've not lived, Max. You've not lived.
Right. Seems very unlikely that I will. Anyway, that'll do for today.
Just quickly, I just wanted to know, like, because everyone on this podcast today is so fashionable, evidently, what did you think of Trent Alexander-Arnold's get up, like the whole sort of like Max and Paddy sort of bouncer gear that he's wearing on the Gucci show?
He's definitely not paid for it. He's been paid to wear it. So as a consequence, I would wear a clown costume. I couldn't care less. You know, more power to him for being given the opportunity to look ridiculous for money.
Oh, I haven't seen it. I need to see it.
Oh, it's amazing. Like there's loads of like Max and Paddy gags about it, and loads of references to Tommy Dickfingers. So yeah, it's worth seeing. I mean, everyone's concentrating on the sort of top half, which is like looks like every bounce everywhere. But he's wearing flares, so I wonder where the flares are coming back in.
Yes, he looks just like Paddy McGuinness, doesn't he? Oh, that's really good. It's a very high, so it's a sort of leather jacket that sort of stops, I would say, just a bit too short. It's just like you've bought a medium when you are a large, right? And what he can't do is put his hands up above his head, because then it'll ride right up and be like a crop top. Oh, that is really, really, and he's wearing these, yeah, really enormous trousers. Are they flares or are they just massive trousers? I'm not really sure.
Max and Paddy's a great shout though. It's a fantastic shout. Yeah.
It's elite. So good. I occasionally I watch, you know, the Tottenham players arrive at training and they get asked some stupid question they don't want to be asked. And they all walk in and like Højbjerg is always wearing just very sensible clothes. And then most of the young players are looking ridiculous. But it's almost like Brian Hill is always just dressed as a Zorb. Like it's just sort of like enormous, like just so it sort of rolls in. It's all peeled out of his clothes. Anyway, that will do for today. It was worth bringing up, Noz. Thank you so much, Paul.
No, thank you.
Thanks, Noz.
Thanks.
Thank you, Nadim.
Pleasure as always.
Football Weekly is produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Danielle Stevens.
This is The Guardian.